All right. Thank you. My name is Rod Mattson. I'm a product manager at Licor Biosciences, and I'm going to talk about requirements for obtaining accurate chamber-based soil gas flux measurements. Just to outline my talk, I'll start out with those requirements for closed chamber-based soil gas flux measurements. Then I'll get into some considerations for just understanding spatial and temporal variations. And then just look at analysis and how someone could optimize their protocol for both the soil type and the gases of interest, and that could be CO2, nitrous oxides, methane isotopes, or whatever the gas might be. First off, we kind of want to define what we mean when we say soil respiration, soil gas flux, or storage. When we think of the storage component is really impacted by a couple of different things. The ambient CO2 concentration has a huge impact on the storage component in the soil. So if you have a boundary layer with very little wind, and maybe that boundary layer is operating at 700 or 800 ppm, that has a very, very large impact on the storage, and you're not getting the diffusion that you might expect because of the boundary layer impacts. Also, soil porosity has a very large impact on the storage component of soil CO2 flux. Or in this, it could be any gas flux. I'll interchange soil CO2 flux because I have a lot of data supporting soil CO2 flux, but nitrous oxide, methane are also very applicable here. When we talk about soil gas flux, we're talking about the actual movement of the gas from the soil, and that's impacted by a number of things as well. We found in a lot of our data sets, especially with methane out of landfills, because of the resolution, that you can see really, really high impacts on just barometric pumping as you have low pressure and high pressure systems moving in, large scale systems moving in, that has very, very, very large impacts on gas fluxes across those entire areas. And so, you know, that's something I think is unappreciated in a lot of situations. Also, the soil respiration component, which I'll talk about in a minute, the ambient concentrations as well, all have an impact on the movement or transport of gas flux. And finally, soil respiration we define sort of as the microbial breakdown of organic matter, impacts from root respiration and growth from photosynthesis, leaf area index, the moisture and temperature component and how they impact the microbial activity. Soil organic matter has a huge impact on microbial activity and production of CO2, in this case CO2. Rain events, I'll talk about their impact on just the production of CO2. And so it's good to be able to understand the differences between these things and how they have an impact on the gas flux. So some mechanisms that regulate soil gas flux. The diffusion gradient is really, really large in terms of how it has an impact. And so that's a big deal in chamber-based measurements, because you'll see that diffusion, obviously when the second that chamber closes down, you've impacted that diffusion gradient. You have to account for that in your data. And also the barometric pressure pumping, just that impact as large-scale high and low pressure systems move in and out, that can have large, very mass movement of gases through just mass flow from the barometric pressure. So first, starting out with the requirements. When we talk about chamber-based measurements, obviously we have to take a measurement, so we need a chamber to take a measurement. But one of the big challenges is that measurement must not be affected by production. You cannot impact the production or the transport of CO2 while you're taking that measurement, and that's the big challenge with any sort of chamber, whether it's a commercial chamber or a homemade chamber. And there's really three. There's a number of requirements, but three really important ones that you have to be very, very aware of when you're doing these measurements. The first one is we need to minimize the disturbance of the environment. So when you're taking a chamber-based measurement, we have to understand that if it's going to be out there in a long-term setting, and we've already saw that the long-term data sets, the diurnal data sets, are very, very important from a resolution standpoint, and they give us a lot of good information, but we want to make sure that the soil temperature and the moisture, we've done it as the best we can to allow those things to be just like it would be if there was no chamber there, and that's a big challenge. Also, the chamber pressure equilibrium. Chamber pressure is a very, very big deal when it comes to chamber-based measurements. A high pressure or a negative pressure or a positive pressure in that chamber will have a large impact on the gas flux. And then, obviously, we don't want to disturb that diffusion gradient. So we want whatever that ambient concentration is at that boundary layer, we want to make sure we're not impacting that when we're taking our measurement. First thing is just minimizing the disturbance to the environment. We've already seen these chambers in a couple of the talks, but one of the things we have to do is we have to make sure we're moving away from that chamber, that measurement area, and we saw that in the last talk. That chamber, when it's not taking a sample, we want to make sure that the rain, the solar load, and all the temperature, everything is as close as we can be to the natural conditions. And so the chamber needs to move away to not impact soil temperature or soil moisture. Chamber pressure equilibrium, this is in a lot of systems that I've been around, can be a very unappreciated or just a something that's not measured very often. But any slight, in this case, a negative pressure in the chamber, and how can you get a negative pressure in the chamber? Well, you have to vent the chamber, and there's a lot of systems out there where maybe the vent acts like a chimney. And so if the wind blows over that vent, you get this negative pressure in the chamber, and you can actually cause upward mass flow, and that can lead to a very, very large overestimation of the flux. And so you're getting an answer, you're getting a number, but you could be very overestimated if you have a negative pressure in that chamber. Same thing with a positive pressure. There are chambers that, in the past, I've seen them where they slam down on the collar or slam down on the gasket. And any time you're moving down on something like that, there's this positive pulse. And that positive pulse would create this, you can have a large underestimate of the flux. Again, you're getting a number, but that pressure in that chamber can have a huge impact on the actual flux that should be occurring outside of that chamber. And that's what you want to measure. So we've actually done, at LIFO, we've done a tremendous amount of work on this pressure issue because we know it's a huge deal for all types of systems because it can have an impact. I mean, you can double your numbers. It can cut them in half, the real number. And so, you know, we have events where basically what we're doing is we're taking that dynamic pressure from the wind and converting it to the static pressure that the soil surface sees, because theoretically at the soil surface, there is no wind. And so the whole goal here is to maintain pressure equilibrium under windy and calm conditions. And Zhu et al. In 2006 published a nice paper in the Journal of Geophysical Research that talks about this vent, talks about the whole method, the Venturi effect, and kind of gives a nice summary of why venting the chamber in the proper way is very, very important. And then the final consideration is no disturbance to the diffusion gradient. Again, when the chamber closes down, that diffusion gradient is immediately impacted. And so the flux is actually slowing down because you went from, say, 400 ppm that you want to measure the flux to now 405, 410, and that gradient slowing down. And so it's not a linear response. It's more of an exponential fit. In the case of CO2, we use an exponential fit. If you use a linear response over the course of 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, you're going to see that response eventually asymptote at the top, and you're going to have an underestimate of the flux because you're taking the average. And that underestimate is really dependent on the soil type. You can have up to 5, 10, in this case 12.8% lower flux rate because we've looked at the linear instead of the exponential fit. And so what we care about is we need enough data to fit that curve back to what that flux was right when that chamber closed down. So now I'm going to move to some of the considerations for having high temporal resolution in your data sets. In this case, we have basically A, B, C, and D. And A is the flux rates. And then you can see just the impacts and why high temporal resolution is very important. Temperature, both soil temperature and air temperature. The concentration in the air, you can see in letter C there, you have concentrations of that boundary layer getting up to 600 ppm. Well, that happens obviously because of flux. But if you have no wind blowing that boundary layer away, now that diffusion gradient is slowing down and your flux is dropping. So same thing, when the wind comes through, the flux changes because that wind is shearing away that boundary layer that's happening near the soil surface. This is another really nice illustration or graphic that shows this same point. Flux rates in the daytime range from 1 to 3 micromoles per meter squared per second. Flux at the nighttime, because you probably have low wind or not so windy conditions, you have that boundary layer that's creeping up to 500, 600, 700 ppm, and your flux rate is hovering around 1 micromole per meter squared per second. But in the daytime, the flux rate is changing because you have temperature changes, you might have moisture changes, microbial activity is really picking up, so you got a lot of things that's just changing that flux. And so changes in air CO2 concentration have an impact on the soil CO2 flux. I've said that a couple times already because it's very, very important to understand that. Also, the transport of CO2 to the atmosphere is often in non-steady state. Because we have all these other things that are going on, it's never really a steady state. The boundary layer is always changing. You have barometric pumping. All these things are happening. Microbial activity is coming and going. As temperatures change, moistures change, it's never really a steady state. So a key thing is that respiration or production of CO2, in this case we're talking about CO2, is never really equal to the actual flux of CO2, because the flux is a completely dependent, not completely dependent on the respiration. So these are really a nice graphic that shows how that, why that happens. Just another interesting data set here. Again, just reiterating, Rich mentioned it as well, the importance of high resolution temporal flux data. This is also CO2 flux. This was 16 chambers in late May and early June, all getting really comparable today, very close. This was in a bean field. It was corn the previous year, so there's a lot of corn stover. And then real dry conditions for a couple of weeks, and then around one day 163, we had a significant rain event. And of those 16 chambers, right after that rain event, some of them went up, doubled, tripled in flux, some of them dropped. And so you ask yourself, well, the system must have broke. The rain broke our measurement system. And that's how I was convinced, actually, that happened until we looked at the data closer, started looking at the collars. And then the fluxes that went up, we noticed we had a lot of refuse from the year before, so corn stover. Again, we had a significant rain event here. And the fluxes that dropped, very little corn stover. So what happened in that rain event was the fluxes that went up, that rain event was so significant that the soil was saturated. So there was no diffusion of gas in the mineral layer of the soil. But the corn stover, high temperatures, was dry, just all of a sudden became very moist. Microbial activity immediately took off. And that corn stover in the previous slide was now breaking down, producing CO2 at the surface. So the surface litter was the impact here. And it had a huge impact on the flux temporarily. It also kind of dropped as the soil dried. What happened here is you had saturation of the soil. There's no diffusion going through that soil right now because the rain completely saturated, maybe even flooded it for a time. So nothing going on. Obviously, it crept back up over time. But very little corn stover, no production of CO2 at the surface. And so really nice data, tight data set, a rain event. You can see the impact on what essentially is the same, in the same field, collars that are very, very close to one another. So the other thing I want to talk about is just the ability to optimize your protocol for the soil type and gases of interest. We've heard a lot of nitrous oxide, some CO2. There's also a lot of methane and isotopes interest out there. And so you want to make sure you have a tool that allows you to do the proper analysis. How long do I want to take my sample is very important. If you do automated chambers, Rich mentioned the importance of power. And power is a really, really big deal. When you're doing automated chambers, you want to be able to maximize your measurements, minimize the power. And so you need a software analysis tool that allows you to say, in this case, with CO2, if I know my soil type and I know how my chambers do the measurement, I can actually set my stop time to 60 seconds. So I can do one sample in 60 seconds. Maybe for nitrous oxide or methane, it's 3, 4, 5 minutes. But what happens, what I know about this is, taking a few samples out in the field, I know that the flux is not changing after 60 seconds. And so I can optimize my soil type, optimize my gas, and just my protocol, and say, okay, I can do 30 measurements in 1 hour. Not a problem, because I don't have to set a 2 or 3 minute sample. And then finally, just an analysis tool that allows you to optimize or integrate all the data. So you want to be able to integrate all these production data, moisture, temperature, all these things are very, very important. And so if you want your methane, your nitrous, all this data sets, you want to be able to integrate all that in a software program that allows you to look at these interactions, because the interactions are really what has the biggest impact on the flux. So just to conclude, I wanted to touch base on the requirements for high-resolution, accurate soil CO2 or soil gas flux measurements. Again, I interchange those quite often. Chamber pressure equilibrium, probably the most important thing. Very don't want to disturb the gas diffusion gradient. You want to minimize the disturbance of the environment. These are three important requirements for successful soil gas flux measurements. Considerations, though. Transport is often in non-steady state, so respiration rarely equals soil CO2 flux, simply because there's so many different interdependent things going on there. And you need high temporal and spatial resolution measurements to really understand what's going on out there. And then analysis, these are not simple measurements. I mean, it is simple sometimes to get a gas analyzer and some sort of box designed to get a number. And what we found out over many years is the number is probably not right unless you've done some of your homework and done some of these things. And so it is very simple to get a number, and you can assume that number is right until you realize you haven't done some of these things. And so They are complex measurements, and they can be simplified with proper analysis tools. And also the data should be integrated to fit the gases of interest. That's all I have.